Hello, this is Henry Mosley again, continuing our discussions in Health Across the Lifespan, and we are going to talk more about conceptual frameworks. This lecture, however, is going to look at how conceptual frameworks are applied to the field of reproductive health, and we are particularly going to look at conceptual frameworks related to three elements in reproductive health. First is fertility, the second is maternal mortality, and the third is perinatal health. This next slide just identifies some of the key questions that we are going to address. When we talk about fertility, I want to start first with looking at how fertility is measured, and then we will get into what are the proximate determinants of fertility, and then I will be looking particularly at which proximate fertility determinants are the most important and why. Then we're going to move to maternal mortality and ask why is it important to have a proximate determinants framework for maternal mortality and morbidity. After we ask that question, we will be looking at what are the proximate determinants of maternal mortality and morbidity, and how do they relate to program strategies to improve maternal health. Next, we are going to look at perinatal health and ask what is meant by an integrated perinatal health framework. This involves the life course and multiple determinants, and so we next come to what are the paths in the life course model for perinatal mortality, and how does an integrated perinatal health framework lead to new thinking about the organization of healthcare systems. First, let's look at fertility. I'm particularly going to focus on the Davis-Blake proximate determinants framework of fertility, and then move on to the work by John Bongartz on this framework, exploring particularly the Bongartz analytical model. Before we get into that, though, I want to start with what do we mean by fertility? The reason this is important is because there are different definitions of fertility used by demographers and social scientists and used by physicians. As a medical professional myself, I used to think of fertility as the potential for a woman to reproduce. For example, if you examined a young woman and she wanted to know whether she was fertile or not, you checked in if all her endocrine functions and reproductive organs were intact, you would say, yes, you are fertile. This is not the demographic definition of fertility. In fact, they would use the word fecund, meaning she has the potential to reproduce, but has not yet actually born a child, a live birth. Demographers count fertility only in terms of the numbers of live births that a woman has. When we look at fertility, we need to consider particularly the length of the reproductive lifespan for women. Now, earlier we'd been talking about the determinants of mortality, and of course the risk of death occurs at every age from the moment of birth until the end of the lifespan. But fertility for women only occurs during a specific time period, and we're going to look at that time period, because this is important in measurement and also in looking at some of the determinants of fertility. Next, we're going to look at the measurements themselves and just briefly talk about how births are produced during the reproductive age and how this is measured as age-specific fertility rate. And because we're going to be talking about total fertility rate, I just briefly want to introduce you to how this is measured. Now, this may be a review for some of you, but for others, you may not be exactly clear on some of these definitions, so it's worthwhile going over it again. This graph shows schematically the potential reproductive lifespan. The horizontal scale is just age from about age 15 or earlier to age 50, and the vertical scale is reproductive potential from 0 to 1. This is not meant to be very accurate at all, but puberty occurs actually now as early as 9, 10, or 11 years old in some women. But then the peak potential reproduction increases rapidly until about age 18, and then there's a gradual decline in reproductive potential over the lifespan. If you sort of calculated the area under that curve, you could say that's about a 25-year period. The lifespan there from 15 to 50, of course, is about 35 years. But actually, not during all of that lifespan does a woman have the potential to reproduce. And so we would say her potential reproductive life is about 25 years or 300 months. That is an average for a population. Obviously, individual women would vary enormously from that average. Now, how do we calculate age-specific fertility rates? Well, this is a graph illustrating that, and across the horizontal scale, we see age groups from 15 to 19 to 40 to 44. We could have extended it out to 45 to 50, but for simplification, I've just stopped at 44 in this particular graph. And the vertical scale is the birth rate per 1,000 women per year. And we see in this graph, for example, in the 15 to 19 age group, 1,000 women each year would produce about 100 births. In the next age group, when most of these women would be married and at their peak reproductive period, 1,000 women would be producing about 400 live births a year in a high fertility population. This would be in a situation where there was not much practice of contraception. Then as the women get older, the potential reproduction capabilities go down, and of course the fertility goes down as well. And you see these numbers dropping 300, 200, 100, and 100. So this is a graph of the age-specific fertility rates. Now, from this graph, we can calculate the total fertility rate by considering that if we had 1,000 women, and starting at age 15, these 1,000 women produced 100 births a year for 5 years until they reached age 19. And then in the next age group, they produced 400 births a year for 5 years until they reached age 25. And then in the next 5-year age group, they would produce 300 births per year for the next 5 years, and so forth. If we added up those age-specific fertility rates, 100 plus 400 plus 300 plus 200 plus 100 plus 100, we would get 1,200. And because a woman is in each one of these age groups for 5 years, we would multiply that times 5, and we would get 6,000. Which is the number of births 1,000 women would produce if they went through their reproductive life following this schedule of fertility. Now, we're more interested in how many births per woman, and so we divide that 6,000 by 1,000 and say, on the average, if a woman went through her reproductive life with this schedule of fertility, she would produce 6 births. And that is called the total fertility rate, which effectively is just a sum of the age-specific fertility rates. I hope that is clear to you. Now, this is actually a schedule of very high fertility. This would be what you might see today in a country like Nigeria or Chad. In the United States, the total fertility rate is somewhat under 2, and so the age-specific fertility rates would be much lower. And of course, many other countries have levels, quite different levels across the age groups. But generally, this is the pattern, and this is the way the total fertility rate is calculated. I might just add for your information that we often speak of replacement fertility, and that would be if the total fertility rate added up to about 2 births per woman. This means the woman is replacing herself in the next generation. Why 2? Because a couple produces the births, and so the 2 births on the average would be 1 boy and 1 girl. To replace the husband and the wife in the next generation. And with replacement fertility, the population would not grow. On the other hand, if she's having 6 births per woman, that means she's having 3 female births, and in the next generation, there would be 3 mothers where there were only 1. And of course, if they continued that in the next generation, there would be 9, and in the next generation, 27, and so on. So you can imagine that populations would grow very fast with very high levels of fertility. This is a brief introduction to fertility. You will no doubt be taking some courses where you will go into this in more detail. But I'm giving you this because we want to talk about the determinants of fertility. First, why are we interested in determinants? Well, the reason is that fertility levels differ in different populations and at different times in the same population. This graph right here shows 5 developing countries. Beginning at the left, you have Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East and North Africa, South Asia, which would be largely India and Bangladesh and Pakistan, Latin America, and East Asia, which would be dominated by China and Japan. And the vertical scale is the total fertility rate. And we have 2 time periods. If you look at the white bars, this is in 1960, and you can see that in that time period, essentially, all of these countries had fertility rates that were very high. averaging about 6 births or more per woman. But 30 years later, in 1990, there's been a dramatic drop in fertility in some of these regions, East Asia in particular, that's primarily dominated by China, then Latin America, then South Asia, the picture we see in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, less so in the Middle East and North Africa, and almost no change in this 30-year period in Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, the question is, why have these fertility rates changed or failed to change? What is going on here? Well, Kingsley Davis and Judith Blake, back in 1956, when they had much less data, and actually, as you can see, much less variation between developing countries, but actually a lot of variation among developed countries. We were seeing already fertility declines in Europe and the United States. The question was raised, why have these fertility rates begun to decline? What is going on? Well, there was an observation, for example, that more educated women had fewer births than less educated women, and richer women had fewer births than poorer women. Couples who lived in the cities had fewer births than those who lived in the rural areas. And so there were a lot of theories about what was going on. In fact, if we look back, some of them were quite amusing. For example, around the turn of the 20th century, around early 1900s, there was a social scientist named Castro, and he observed that women with more education had substantially fewer births than women with less education in a number of developed countries. And he sort of developed the hypothesis that somehow, as women got more and more information embedded into their brains, their reproductive capabilities degenerated in some way or another. And so that education, in some way, by some mechanism that he obviously couldn't sort out, was causing a direct reduction in fertility, in the potential to reproduce. Well, we're amused, but we have to recognize how little was known historically. As a result, in 1956, when Judith Blake and Kingsley Davis, two very famous demographers, explored this in more depth, they came up with the concept of the proximate determinants of fertility. And basically what they said was that there are underlying determinants of fertility, like education, like income, like urban residence, like high social status. And somehow these related to the number of births a woman would have in a reproductive life, but that in order for this to occur, these underlying determinants had to operate on what they called intermediate or proximate determinants. Sometimes these are also called sociobiological mechanisms. In other words, somehow there had to be a mechanism that connected education to lower birth rates. And in studying this in quite a number of populations, they came up with three broad groups of mechanisms and about 14 components of these. This I will show you in the next slide. They said that for fertility to vary across populations, three things had to happen in some combination or another. One was the factors related to exposure to intercourse. If a woman, for example, was never married, she would never have any births. If she married late, she would have fewer births than if she married early. If she was divorced somewhere early in her reproductive career, she would have fewer births. All of these were factors affecting the exposure to intercourse. Next, if she was in a marital union, it wasn't necessarily true that she would conceive, and so they identified a second set of factors that related to the likelihood that she would conceive, given that she was in a sexual union. And then third, even though a conception would occur, this would not necessarily lead to a live birth. There could be a spontaneous fetal loss, or they could be an induced abortion. And so they identified a third group of factors affecting gestation and successful parturition. Parturition, for some of you, is just a medical term for a live birth. So let's look at this in just a little bit more depth. Those factors affecting exposure to intercourse, they broke them down into two major groups. The first are those factors governing the formation and dissolution of sexual unions in the reproductive period, and for example, the age of entry into sexual unions. Fertility would be very different among a population of women who are getting married around age 12 or 13 versus those who are getting married around the age of 25 or 30. Likewise, if a certain fraction of the population never married, this would also produce much lower rates of fertility. Now, just to go back for a moment and say that, you know, why these variations occur in some developing countries, women are brought into marriage as soon as they experience menstruation, and so their age of entry into sexual union may be as early as 12 or 13. In other countries, like China, women generally may not marry until age 25 or 30, or enter into a sexual union until that time. Permanent celibacy was very common in Europe, certainly in the Middle Ages, when only firstborn sons technically should marry, and that the rest of the children, sons and daughters, had little option except perhaps to go into the priesthood or become a nun. And so there was a high frequency of permanent celibacy in European populations 200 years ago, for example. Then, of course, if the union was broken by divorce or separation or desertion or death of the husband, then, of course, there would be less opportunity for a woman to produce a child. Now, secondly, if the woman was in a sexual union, there were still factors that governed whether or not she was exposed to intercourse within the union. There may be voluntary abstinence. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, after a child is born, there's abstinence for a year or two or three in some cases in order to make sure that that child has a healthy development before the woman has a second child. There's also involuntary abstinence if one of the partners is sick or severely disabled. And also, there's some variation related to coital frequency. This, for example, would relate to age of the couple. Newlyweds obviously have high coital frequency and high rates of fertility in the early years of marriage. Older couples have lower coital frequency and lower fertility rates in the course of their marriage. And so you see that decline in fertility with age among women, which is not strictly a biological factor, but may also relate to behavioral factors as well. Coming to the second major factor, given that a sexual union with intercourse exists, the woman may not necessarily conceive. And Kingsley Davis and Judith Blake identified three factors related to the risk of conception. First, there was fecundity or infecundity as affected by involuntary causes. Now, fecundity here means the potential to reproduce. And so that a woman might have, or the man, for example, might have a genetic defect such that the couple cannot conceive. Or they may get a disease, the woman may get a disease like gonorrhea or chlamydia, which could produce permanent sterility. And so even though she was having regular sexual relations with her partner, a conception might not occur. Second was the use or non-use of contraception, obviously a very powerful factor, and we'll come back to that. And then there was fecundity or infecundity affected by voluntary causes, including surgical sterilization or other types of medical treatment that might affect fertility. For example, hysterectomy because of some disease or another. The third major factor was given that pregnancy occurs, there were a set of factors that affected gestation and successful parturition, that is the production of a live birth. First, there was the probability of fetal mortality from involuntary causes. There's naturally occurring fetal wastage and stillbirth, but also in areas, for example, where there's a high level of malaria. Malaria can cause premature fetal mortality. But then there's fetal mortality from voluntary causes, specifically induced abortion, so that the woman does not produce a live birth. So basically, Kingsley Davis and Judith Blake concluded that all underlying determinants of fertility had to operate through one of these three factors, and they identified all of the components they could think of that were connected and that could be classified under one of these three groups of factors. Now, I want to talk a bit about the work of John Bongartz. He followed up on the work of Kingsley Davis and Judith Blake, who had identified the fact that all underlying determinants must operate through one or more proximate determinants. And he asked two questions. Which of these are more important? Because Judith Blake and Kingsley Davis had identified 14, and that's pretty complicated to handle. And if he could find out which ones are more important, can these be easily measured in a way that we can look at the differences in fertility across different populations? So let's go back to this graph we showed of trends in fertility in developing countries. And you see, for example, again, in two time periods, substantial decline in fertility in East Africa, Latin America, and South Asia, and less so in the Middle East, and almost none in Sub-Saharan Africa. Well, if you want to know which proximate determinants are more important, you can look at them one by one. And the most obvious one to look at in this time period is the practice of contraception. And indeed, looking at these same two time periods, we see the trends in contraceptive use among these same countries. They're arrayed in the same order on this graph in 1960, and we see these same trends in 1990. And the picture is pretty striking. In 1960, the levels of contraceptive use were somewhere under 5% to somewhere around 10 to 15% for all of these countries. Contraceptive practice was pretty rare in all of these developing countries in 1960. 30 years later, we see a dramatically changed picture. In East Asia, contraceptive use is now 70%. 70% of women in the reproductive age are using contraception. In Latin America, about 60%. In South Asia, about 40%. In the Middle East, about 35%, and hardly any at all. So, if you recall the previous slide, we can see that there is a very striking relationship between the increase in contraceptive use in these developing country regions and the decline in fertility. This makes it pretty clear that one of the most obvious, important proximate determinants of fertility is contraceptive use. In fact, if we look country by country in this graph, we see the same pattern in much more detail. The horizontal scale here is the level of contraceptive practice among married women, and it's from 0% to 90%. And the vertical scale is the total fertility rate. And the red dots are a whole bunch of countries, developed and developing countries, around 1990, in the early to mid-1990s. And you see clearly that among countries with a low contraceptive prevalence, 10 to 20%, total fertility rates are very high. And among those with high contraceptive prevalence, 60, 70, 80%, fertility rates are low. And you can draw a line, as was done here, a regression line, and find that there is a very, very strong correlation. This is a highly significant correlation between contraceptive prevalence and the total fertility rate. And so right off, we can say one of the big factors in modern times, certainly, determining the differences in fertility across countries is the level of contraceptive practice. However, although the line is very impressive, there's a huge amount of deviation of countries from the line. So other factors must be playing a role. And some of the most striking ones, if you can see it clearly on your monitor, at 25% contraceptive prevalence, you have the country of Ukraine with a total fertility rate of about 1.5. It's way, way off the line. That was a former Eastern European country, and in fact, a number of other Eastern European countries have relatively low contraceptive prevalences, but very, very low fertility. If you just went on and looked at the range of 1 to 2 births, you would see that in contraceptive prevalence of 50 to 60%, countries like Latvia and Kazakhstan and Belarus and Lithuania and Romania. And then Japan is there as well. How can countries with such a low level of contraceptive prevalence produce such low fertility? Something else must be going on. And in fact, as we now know, the big factor here for all of these countries is abortion. Namely, that they may not be using contraceptives with high frequency or very effectively, but they are reducing their fertility by aborting unwanted pregnancies. On the other side, you may find countries that deviate quite high above the line, and they're practicing contraception but do not seem to have as low a fertility as might be expected, so something else is going on here. And there's a country, Paraguay, you might not be able to see with the prevalence that's reported as high as 60%, but a relatively high fertility of about 4.5. And we know in that country and in some of the others that a lot of that contraceptive practice is traditional methods, which is not very effective. And so they end up with more births than you might predict based on this regression line. So by studying differences in fertility across countries, one can begin to make some assessment of which ones of the determinants are more important and what other determinants are playing a role. So this is what John Bongartz began to do. First, he looked and said, of the intermediate fertility variables, or the proximal determinants, which ones that Kingsley Davis and Judith Blake identified are more important? And so he identified seven of these first, and you see these in this next slide here. These are the proportions of women married among reproductive age, contraceptive use and use effectiveness, the prevalence of abortion, the duration of postpartum infecundability. There's that word fecund again, but in this case it means infecundability, means the woman is not able to conceive at this time. And this is due to breastfeeding. We now know very clearly that prolonged and intensive breastfeeding will suppress ovulation for an extended period of time, up to 2 and even up to 3 years in some populations. Fecundability, or the frequency of intercourse, could be a factor, particularly with age. A spontaneous intrauterine mortality is a factor that was frequently documented, for example, in highly malarious areas. And the prevalence of permanent sterility, either due to disease or to some type of a genetic defect. So he identified these seven as being most commonly studied. Now, which ones are more important? He then developed this little chart, and he looked at each one of these, and he asked two questions. The first question relates to, across populations, if you change, for example, that first variable, proportion married, how big a change in fertility will occur in populations? And of course, at the extremes, if no one is married or in a sexual union, fertility would be zero. And if everyone is married in a sexual union and not preventing births in any other method, by any other means, fertility would be very, very high. And so he said proportions married has a very strong effect on the change in fertility across populations. The second question he asked was, okay, it has a strong effect, but how much does it vary across populations? Because something may have a strong effect, like genetic defect in fertility, but it may not vary among populations. And so in asking that question, it was clear that proportions married varies enormously across populations. In some developing country populations, literally 95% of the women are married throughout their reproductive years. In more developed countries, it may be less than half are married throughout their reproductive years. And so based on the crude scoring, as you see on the bottom, the scoring ranking high, medium, and low, he then rated these fertility variables in terms of how important they were. And proportion married was very important. Similarly, contraceptive use has a powerful effect on fertility and varies enormously across populations, so it got a high rating. Likewise, prevalence of induced abortion has a strong effect, not quite as strong as contraception, but it varied enormously across populations and got a high rating. And similarly, we now know that breastfeeding practices producing a prolonged period of infertility, or infecundability, that is, because of suppression of ovulation, has a substantial effect in prolonging the space between births. So it has a substantial effect on fertility and also has great variability among populations. In most developed countries, breastfeeding is almost zero, and in developing countries, in some settings, it can be 2 or 3 years. So it also had a high overall rating. Then fecundability, you can see the last three, spontaneous intrauterine mortality and permanent sterility, did not produce much variation in fertility, and likewise did not vary very greatly across populations, and so they received a lower ranking. Now, this is not to say that in a particular population, for example, where there might be a high level of sexually transmitted diseases, that permanent sterility might not be important, but across the vast majority of populations, Bongartz concluded that the first four identified on this chart were the most important intermediate fertility variables, or proximate determinants of fertility, and that these could account for most of the variations we see in populations. How do these work? Well, what Bongartz did was to develop a series of indices, and I want to illustrate this by this graph. We're not going to go into all the calculations of the indices. That's really not the purpose of this lecture. But it's important to know that he developed these and they could be measured. This is a graph, that shows the total fertility rate in a population and then the total fecundity, which would be the potential fertility if the women were marrying at the youngest age and having births as fast as they could until they reached the oldest age. The total fecundity, Bongartz has estimated in the average population, would be about 15.3 births per woman. Those are single births. This doesn't include twins or triplets. But if a woman had one birth at a time over her reproductive life and she married as soon as she had onset of menstruation and stayed married and in an active sexual union, potentially she could have 15.3 births on the average in a population of women. And yet we see the total fertility rate is much lower. It might be 8 or 6 or 4 or 2 or 1 in, say, Beijing, China. So what he determined was that if you looked at the total fertility rate, that or the total fecundity, that there was a reduction in the total fecundity in part because of a high proportion of the women or a substantial proportion of women who were breastfeeding. And therefore, they were spacing their births with breastfeeding. And so their potential fecundity was reduced by some fraction, and this varied across populations. That would produce what he generated as another measure called the total natural marital fertility rate. Then there would be a further reduction in the potential fertility by those women who were effectively contracepting in the population, a further reduction in the potential by those women who were aborting pregnancies that they didn't want, and finally there would be a further reduction in potential fertility by women who never married or who divorced or who married late or whose husband died. And so that the total fertility rate observed in a population was the net number of births per woman over her reproductive life, taking into account the potential that was reduced by these four major factors. Now, I want to mention the fact that John Bongartz developed four readily measurable indexes for the proximate determinants. We won't go into detail about these indexes and how they are measured. I just want to make the point, though, that in ordinary population surveys that are done, like the Demographic and Health Survey, they collect the data that makes it possible to measure these indexes and determine how much each of these four factors contributes to the level of fertility we see in that population. But let me just mention what these indexes are. One is called C sub M, and it's the index of marriage. And all indexes would have a range of 0 to 1. And it would be 1 if all women were married, and 0 if none were married. And obviously the real index in a population would be somewhere between 0 and 1. The index of contraception would equal 1 if no one was using contraception, therefore you had the maximum fertility, and 0 if all fecund women were using contraception, that was 100% effective. Note the fact that the index of contraception takes into account two factors. One is the proportion of women who are using contraception, but second, the effectiveness of use. For example, if 100 women were sterilized in the next year or 5 years or 10 years, we would expect no births because sterilization would be essentially 100% effective. On the other hand, if 100 women were using condoms in the next year, we might expect 5, 10, 15, or 20 births, and maybe over the next 10 years, we might expect about half the women to get pregnant because condoms are not 100% effective. And so the index of contraception takes into account both the percentage of women who are using contraception, but that percentage is also weighted in effect by how effective the contraceptive use is. The index of abortion, as with the others, equals 1 if there's no induced abortion, and 0 if all pregnancies are aborted. And similarly, the index of postpartum infecundability, that is the period after a live birth that the woman breastfeeds and is not ovulating, it would equal 1 in the absence of lactation, meaning that the woman doesn't breastfeed at all and she would have the potential to conceive in about 1.5 to 2 months after the birth. And it's 0 if the duration of infecundability is infinite. In other words, all of the indices are between 0 and 1. And so if the index is not operating, if there is no abortions, for example, the index is 1. And if a high percentage of women are aborting, the index would be somewhere below 1, obviously not as low as 0 in any real population. The total fertility rate would then be calculated by just the product of these four indices. The index of marriage times the index of contraception times the index of abortion times the index of infecundability times the potential, which is 15.3. And so you can see by looking at that hopefully simple equation that the total fertility of 15.3 is reduced in some proportion according to the proportion that each of these indices is less than 1. Obviously, if all of the indexes were 1, then the potential fertility of the population would be the same as the total fecundity. But the indexes are less than 1, then the total fertility rate will be substantially below the total fecundity. So what does this look like when we look at real populations? Well, at the time Bongartz was working out these equations, he had data from 41 countries where they measured both the total fertility rate directly from a survey, but they also had measures of the proportion of women who were married, the proportion of those women who were using contraception, how effective the contraception was, the proportion of women who were practicing abortion, and the proportion practicing breastfeeding. And so he did the calculation. And what you see on this graph is the scale across the horizontal scale is the observed total fertility rate. That is what was directly calculated from the data. And on the vertical scale is the total fertility rate estimated from these four proximate determinants or intermediate fertility variables, estimating each proximate determinant one by one, developing the index, multiplying it times the total fecundity of 15.3, and generating an estimated total fertility rate. And note the fact that just using these four proximate determinants and developing these indices, you get a series of estimated fertility rates that are very, very close to the observed total fertility rates. There's a relatively small error, and that error no doubt is in large measure due to measurement errors, either directly in the observed total fertility rate or in the data that he had to generate the indices. So let's just take it a little bit further, and then I'll be concluding this component of the lecture. Based on these indices and looking at a wide variety of countries, Bongartz was able to give a picture of what it might look like as a population went through the fertility transition from high fertility to low fertility over a period of, say, 25, 50, 100 years, for example. And time period 1 in the horizontal scale would be prior to any external forces reducing fertility, prior to any social and economic determinants, so to speak. And the total fertility rate in that population would be about 8. Most of the women would be married, and so you see that there's very little reduction in the potential fecundity by non-marriage. But most of these women would be breastfeeding and spacing their births 3 years or 4 years, perhaps. And so the reason you have a total fertility rate of 8 instead of a total fertility rate of 15.3 is because in most traditional populations, there's very prolonged breastfeeding, there's very prolonged lactational infecundability, and therefore this reduces the potential very substantially. Now, what happens as fertility begins to decline with modernization? We see the total fertility rate in the next graph going down to about 5, a very substantial reduction. And what is happening then is the index of non-marriage is going up. More women are not marrying or marrying later. And then some women are getting pregnant, but they've determined that they don't want to carry these pregnancies to term, and so abortion is beginning to be practiced. Similarly, women are learning how to contracept, and so you see the level of contraception increasing. And at the same time with modernization, breastfeeding is beginning to diminish. In the third time period, which would be for a lot of developing countries at the present time, perhaps Indonesia or Bangladesh, fertility rate is going down to about 2.5. Again, later marriage is becoming more common. Abortion is also becoming more common, as well as contraception. And what is happening often in these situations is that there's a real driving force with economic development, with education, and more prosperity, that couples are deciding they want smaller families. They're learning to practice contraception, but they may not always be able to access the services. and so they are terminating their pregnancies with abortion. And note the fact also that breastfeeding is diminishing even further with modernization, as we know occurs, for example, in the United States. Finally, when a country has reached the transition and fertility is now at 2 or lower, there is even more non-marriage or delay in marriage and also never marrying. Abortion is going down now because contraceptive practice is becoming the norm and is becoming more readily available, and perhaps more effective methods like sterilization are much more widely available. And breastfeeding has virtually disappeared. And so this gives you a picture of more or less the transition in fertility over time and how each one of these indexes play a role. I want to just give you one more illustration, because in the early 1980s, Dr. Wang and L.P. Cho and others wanted to know why fertility in Beijing, China was less than 1. It was somewhere about 0.8 or 0.9, extremely low. And so they had a survey in Beijing, and they calculated these indices to see what is going on. Well, you can see the main reason fertility is very low in this particular urban setting is a high percentage of the women either never married or delayed marriage until very late, or they got divorced after they were married. Similarly, abortion was practiced at a relatively high frequency and also a very high level of contraceptive practice, but very, very little breastfeeding in this urban setting. Now, actually, this particular analysis had important policy implications, because one would have expected by this time, with contraceptives being widely available, that the abortion rates should not be as high as they were. But one of the observations was that a lot of the contraceptives being used were condoms, and that these condoms had a very high failure rate, and so that the women were resorting to abortion in order to rid themselves of this unwanted pregnancy. And as a result of this study, the government decided that they needed to introduce more effective contraceptives. If they wanted spacing, they would try to get women to use the pills or the IUD. And if the women did not want another birth, they should move from condoms to sterilization. But in any event, this shows you in a real-world situation both the importance of the calculations in understanding what was going on, but also the policy importance of the calculations, recognizing the fact that there remained a high level of abortion, which the government and the people obviously would prefer not to have, and the solution was to get more effective contraceptive use in that particular setting. So let me summarize this section by saying that we know there are great variations in fertility among different populations in developing and developed countries, both across the countries and within the countries. The underlying causes of these variations are socioeconomic and cultural factors. But all of these underlying factors must operate through proximate or socio-biological mechanisms, such as contraceptive practice or delaying marriage or having an abortion or breastfeeding. And the major proximate determinants relate to these four factors that I've just mentioned: marriage, contraception, abortion, and breastfeeding. These determinants can explain most of the variation in fertility that we see across populations and within populations. Okay, this concludes this section. In the next section, I'm going to look at the proximate determinants of maternal mortality.